Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this weekend edition of our English feature program. Today you can hear Jill Bevilacqua's reflections entitled There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. That's followed by Joan Knows, with our resident Vatican expert Joan Lewis taking a look back at Pope Benedict's activities over the past 7 days. We begin today's programme then with There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Here's Sean Patrick Lovett to read to us the Gospel for this 25th Sunday in Ordinary Time.
Jesus told his disciples this parable. The reign of God is like the case of the owner of an estate who went out at dawn to hire workmen for his vineyard. After reaching an agreement with them for the usual daily wage, he sent them out to his vineyard. He came out about mid-morning and saw other men standing around the marketplace without work, so he said to them, "You too, go along to my vineyard and I will pay you whatever is fair." At that they went away. He came out again around noon and mid-afternoon and did the same. Finally, going out in late afternoon, he found still others standing around. To these he said, "Why have you been standing here idle all day?" "No one has hired us," they told him. He said, "You go to the vineyard too." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workmen and give them their pay, but begin with the last group and end with the first." When those hired late in the afternoon came up, they received a full day's pay, and when the first group appeared, they supposed they would get more. Yet they received the same daily wage. Thereupon they complained to the owner, "This last group did only an hour's work, but you've put them on the same basis as us who've worked a full day in the scorching heat." "My friend," he said to one in reply, "I do you no injustice. You agreed on the usual wage, did you not? Take your pay and go home. I intend to give this man who was hired last the same pay as you. I am free to do as I please with my money, am I not? Or are you envious because I am generous? Thus the last shall be first, and the first shall be last."
Of all the occupations a man might follow, none is so often mentioned by our Lord in his parables as that of the worker in a vineyard. It must have been a very familiar image, as we're told that in the Old Testament, the vineyard was the established figure of Israel, God's chosen people, and the Lord of the vineyard was God. Isaiah writes of the vineyard of Yahweh.
Sing of the delightful vineyard. I, Yahweh, am its keeper. Every moment I water it, for fear its leaves should fall. Night and day I watch over it. I am angry no longer. If thorns and briars come, I will declare war on them. I will burn them every one. Or if they would shelter under my protection, let them make their peace with me.
In Advent, we read Isaiah's celebrated vision of everlasting peace, explained in the Missal by this note: "The Lord will gather all nations together into the eternal peace to form the kingdom of God." The prophet Micah echoes these words of Isaiah, but after the first familiar lines, he adds something of his own.
"They will hammer their swords into plowshares, their spears into sickles. Nation will not lift sword against nation. There will be no more training for war. Each man will sit under his vine and his fig tree, with no one to trouble him."
These words must have been familiar to the people of Shakespeare's time, for he echoes Micah in the speech made by Archbishop Cranmer to King Henry VIII, prophesying a reign of peace when his newly born daughter Elizabeth shall come to the throne.
In her days, every man shall eat in safety under his own vine what he plants, and sing the merry songs of peace to all his neighbours.
We might today wonder that Englishmen should be cultivating vines in what is hardly an ideal climate. But they did, and at Hampton Court, the magnificent country house on the bank of the River Thames, which Cardinal Wolsey presented to Henry VIII in a desperate attempt to regain his favour, you can go and see the great vine, which was planted in 1769, the oldest vine in England. Its roots are supposed to have reached the river 60 feet away. And in its heyday, it produced over 2,000 bunches of grapes a year. But by the 20th century, it was bearing less than half the number, and these were sold for charity. Throughout the centuries, then, the vine and vineyard have been a part of everyday life. Likewise, the symbolism. But when we listen to today's parable, which has been described as one of the most disconcerting, we're invariably perplexed, and yes, disconcerted. Automatically, we side with the men who have worked a full day in the scorching heat, and complain because they don't receive more than those who've only worked an hour. But, comments a biblical scholar, the parable is not intended to present a model of trade union practice. As with so many, if not all, the parables, we have to try and put aside our preconceptions, our prejudices, our ideas of justice, and all the impedimenta of our modern mentality, and our calculating, worldly way of interpreting a hypothetical situation. But let's say for a moment that we're looking at a real one. It's vintage time, and the owner of a vineyard wastes no time but goes out at dawn to hire day labourers. And he knows he'll find them. And indeed, there they are in the marketplace, where it was the custom in the East for those seeking work to wait, in the hope of finding it. Every day would be the same for the casual labourer. Each new dawn would bring fresh hope, that today would be better than yesterday. Dawn can be so different for different people. For some, it can bring a sense of relief after a sleepless night. For others, it means the return of problems, perhaps of pain. Others again greet the new day with joy, with anticipation. And to be up and about it early-like can bring its own rewards and surprises, as Irish poet Seamus Heaney discovered.
Travelling south at dawn, going full out through high-up stone-wall country, the rocks still cold, rainwater gleaming here and there ahead, I took a turn and met the fox, stock still, face to face in the middle of the road. Wildness tore through me as he dipped and wheeled in a level-running, tawny breakaway. Oh, neat head, fabled brush, and astonished eye, my blue Volkswagen flared into with morning.
Well, you don't have to be a Nobel Prize-winning poet to be blessed with such gifts. But as George Meredith wrote, prose can paint evening and moonlight, but poets are needed to sing the dawn. Most of us, as a rule, will be found still abed when dawn breaks, but we all have occasion to be up before the sun now and then, be it for duty or pleasure. Of the latter, I could hardly forget climbing up from the sleeping city of Athens to watch dawn break over the Acropolis, or catching the milk train to Covent Garden Market to study the bustling activity of this extraordinary place and its protagonists, the 2,000 or so porters with their great baskets of fruit or vegetables on their heads. As Arthur Mee wrote,
baskets piled up on their heads as high as lampposts. They have basket-carrying competitions, and the champion must carry 25. There is humour here among them, and among the women, shelling peas in summer or walnuts in autumn. It's only a small number of people who find any glory in this market. But in the early hours of the morning, this higgledy-piggledy place is touched with beauty. Then it is a blaze of colour and filled with the scent of flowers, banks of lilies, stalls hidden with roses, and in due season, every English flower that blooms.
Small wonder, then, that the makers of the musical My Fair Lady should have set a famous scene here. For those of us of the older generations, Dawn may not hold the same fascination as it once did, but there's still the memory of those times far back in the careless years of youth when we danced until dawn. And even now, there's always the Dawn chorus. Although for poets, Dawn is said to be rosy-fingered, for the casual labourer of 19th-century England, it didn't always offer rosy prospects. As Thomas Hardy wrote in 1883 in an essay entitled The Dorsetshire Labourer.
He should be viewed when attending a wet hiring fair at Candlemas in search of a new master. His natural cheerfulness bravely struggles against the weather and the incertitude. But as the day passes on, and his clothes get wet through, and he is still unhired, there does appear affectatiousness in the smile, which, with a self-repressing manliness hardly to be found among any other class, he yet has ready when he encounters and talks with friends who have been more fortunate.
Hardy's labourer would not have been hired for a vineyard, of course, and the scene was a wet English February, not a scorching hot day in Palestine. But the uncertainty, the hazardous life, is the same. And here's a present-day hireling in this poem by Welshman R.S. Thomas.
Cars pass him by. He'll never own one. Men won't believe in him for this. Let them come into the hills and meet him wandering a road, fenced with rain, as I have now. The wind feathering his hair, the sky's ruins gutted with fire of the late sun, smouldering still. Nothing is his, neither the land nor the land's flocks. Hired to live on hills too lonely, sharing his hearth with cats and hens, he has lost all property but the grey ice of a face splintered by life's stone.
One of American poet Robert Frost's most famous poems is The Death of the Hired Man. Silas, described by one critic as an old, incompetent hired hand, shiftless and proud, has been found by the farmer's wife, fast asleep, huddled against the barn door. It's winter time, and she begs her husband to be kind to him.
When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back. I told him so last haying, didn't I? If he left then, I said, that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him at his age, for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes always when I need him most. In haying time, when any help is scarce. In winter he comes back to us. I'm done. Where did you say he'd been?
He didn't say.
What did he say? Did he say anything?
But little.
Anything? Mary, confess he said he'd come to ditch the meadow for me.
Of course he did. What would you have him say? Surely you wouldn't grudge the poor old man some humble way to save his self-respect? He added, if you really care to know, he meant to clear the upper pasture, too. That sounds like something you've heard before. Remember the boy you had in haying 4 years since? He's finished school and teaching in his college. Silas declares you'll have to get him back. He says they two will make a team for work. Between them, they will lay this farm as smooth. He thinks if he could have another chance to teach him how to build a load of hay. He thinks if he could teach him that, he'd be some good, perhaps, to someone in the world. Poor Silas, so concerned for other folk, and nothing to look backward to with pride, and nothing to look forward to with hope. So now and never any different. Frost's hired man is not the day labourer, but rather the seasonal worker. But his spirit is that of those whom Hardy calls the free labourers of the Middle Ages. A spirit which still exists today in the men and women who choose to live by casual labour, without ties, without commitments, despite every effort of the organized world of civilization to draw them into itself. And where do they fit into our parable? Probably they're the workers who are taken on at the 11th hour, not being as presentable, maybe, as those who were hired first. But the employer treats all the same, giving a full day's pay to the last as to the first. The 12-hour working day began at dawn and ended when the first stars appeared. At vintage time, it would have begun at 6 in the morning and ended at 6 in the evening. According to the law, the workman had to be paid the same evening, as we read in Deuteronomy.
You are not to exploit the hired servant who is poor and destitute, whether he is one of your brothers or a stranger who lives in your towns. You must pay him his wage each day, not allowing the sun to set before you do, for he is poor and anxious for it.
We might think this expression of the poor man's anxiety an explanation for the owner's treatment of all in like manner. But the parable, write the biblical experts, is to be interpreted this way.
It is the celebration of grace which goes beyond the merits of man. Its purpose is to enhance divine generosity, which goes further than the strict rules of justice. But there is a specific aspect which reflects the situation in which Christ's work takes place. Israel and the just are certainly rewarded for their commitment, but with them are rewarded also the publicans, the sinners and the outsiders who have been converted after their life of sin. The first and the last are all saved by the merciful love of God, which goes beyond the mere material calculation of the just deeds carried out.
Well, it all seems to boil down to the old familiar words, once again in Isaiah.
For my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways not your ways.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now our resident Vatican expert Joan Lewis is back to tell us about Pope Benedict's activities over the past week. Today, Joan talks to my colleague Susie Hodges.
Okay, Joan. Right, so this week, well, of course, it started off with the end of the papal visit to Paris and Lourdes. And, of course, we're still getting the feedback and the ripples from that trip, aren't we?
Well, and from the Holy Father himself, who spoke of his trip at the Wednesday audience, which has become actually traditional for a pope at the Wednesday General Audience following an apostolic trip to talk about that trip. But if you, even the press reports, media reports, Father Lombardi of Vatican Radio and of the press office has made comments, obviously, on the trip, which was viewed as very, very positive. And, of course, our listeners should know, and they may have already heard, that the Pope was going on a visit which many foresaw as very difficult because France has been called for so many centuries the eldest daughter of the Church. And yet it is a country where, in contrast to about 30 years ago, where 80% of the French called themselves Catholic, today that is 51% only call themselves Catholic. How many actually attend Mass are on Sundays regularly, that's only about 10%. So the eldest daughter of the Church, as France is called, was having some problems, and the Holy Father knew that. The Church attendance has declined, as we just said. Catholic marriages have declined, vocations have declined precipitously. But the Holy Father did find a very lively faith when he went there, when he addressed the young people, when he spoke to the world of culture, when he addressed bishops, priests, seminarians, and men and women religious. He did find, it might have been smaller but in numbers, but he did find a very vibrant faith. He himself said that. And
a warm welcome. welcome.
And an extremely warm welcome, which obviously you're going to expect at Lourdes. Of course you are, this Marian shrine par excellence. But his reception in France, in Paris, excuse me, where, of course, his plane landed, was equally warm. And it was very interesting to notice that President Sarkozy, he broke with protocol and welcomed him personally, just as President Bush did when the Pope went to the United States. By going to the airport and personally greeting the Holy Father. And one of the problems has been the fact that for over 100 years now, the idea of laïcité or secularism has been enshrined in French law, a distinction between church and state that almost seems to exceed in many, many ways the distinction between church and state that we have in the United States. And the Holy Father was trying to say what Sarkozy had actually said on a visit, I think it was last year, to the Vatican. He said, the Holy Father was trying to say, these are two distinct entities. You've got the religious sphere, you've got the political sphere, but they can cooperate. They don't have to be totally separate, one not having anything to do with the other. And in fact, of course, he was stressing the Christian roots, not only of France, but actually of all of Europe, which the European Constitution, they are trying not to even mention the word Christianity, Christian roots, and yet you've got almost two millennia of Christianity in so many European countries, in particular France. So the Holy Father was saying there are these two spheres, yes, but they really should be able to coexist peacefully side by side and one augment the other, certainly to bring all the moral, ethical values of a religious practice, of a religious faith into the public sphere.
Indeed, and not compete, feel the need to compete with each other.
Exactly. It's not like you have to choose between being political, so to speak, being a citizen and being a religious person. You can be both things at the same time. So we had the Holy Father addressing the bishops and addressing the young people who were just absolutely going crazy for him. And that was a wonderful thing to see. And it's great when you take an older man, almost a grandfather figure, but these kids do treat them like they were a younger generation rock star. And, you know, that's really not a bad thing at all, to have that kind of love and esteem and enthusiasm for the leader of the Catholic Church. Now,
indeed,
we've kind of talked about Paris a bit, which was a very wonderful visit. It was just about a day, maybe not
just over a day. Yeah.
Just over a day. 24 hours. And then the Holy Father did go to Lourdes. There were two masses at Lourdes. Probably the day that he left to return to Rome, Monday, was a very moving mass. That was a mass for the sick people. And interestingly enough, in talking to a number of the journalists who were on the plane, they were telling me that they, in talking to French citizens, discovered, of course, you had Paris in the north, should we say, and Lourdes, obviously, in the southern part of France, just adjacent practically to Spain. You had French pilgrims from the middle part of France, who decided to, they went to Lourdes instead of Paris. So, and there were just absolutely massive crowds at Lourdes. The Holy Father had wonderful things to say about life and death. He had said what the Church, of course, has always preached, that death occurs. There is a natural end to life. We don't take life. We are not supposed to take lives ourselves. That's in God's hand. And so when he was with so many of the sick people at Lourdes, and he said that, you know, live your life no matter the pain, no matter
there's
the frustration.
There's value in suffering.
There's value in suffering. Life has its natural end. God knows when that's going to be. It can cause even crises of faith. He knows that, pain and illness. But he said that if you have your faith and keep your faith, that this suffering will bring great, great graces.
Yeah. Well, moving on now to Tuesday of this week, Pope Benedict sent a message to all those taking part in the prayer services on the eve of the UN General Assembly. Tell us something about what was said in that message, Joan, and what it means.
Yes, indeed, there was a prayer service organized by Cardinal Ian of New York and Celestino Migliori, the Vatican representative, Archbishop Celestino Migliori. And it preceded, it was the eve before the opening of the 63rd session of the General Assembly. So you had many diplomatic members present for the mass, staff members of the United Nations. And it was, the message was written by, sent by Cardinal Bertone, but of course it was in the Holy Father's name. And the Pope obviously sent greetings to everybody taking part in the prayer service, but really beyond that to the diplomats and by extension to the UN staff members. And he said he would implore, you know, God for the guidance and strength to carry out the urgent tasks, which we all know are facing the United Nations in the coming months. He spoke of the implementation of the Millennium Goals. And he said these are initiatives which are aimed at ensuring that the whole human family shares in the benefits of globalization. That is one of the great concerns, obviously, of the Holy See, because it seems that sometimes this globalization, which is supposed to involve everybody, ends up being only in the hands, the benefits of a few. And the Holy Father said, among other things, he said he really renewed an appeal to all the international leaders, who of course will be speaking coming weeks at the UN, to reappropriate, was his word, the lofty moral vision and the transcendent principles of justice embodied in the United Nations founding documents. And he said he urged them to strengthen the leaders, to strengthen their commitment to upholding the dignity of each human person and building a world of ever greater solidarity, freedom, and peace. So a wonderful message. I'm sure it was very uplifting for those meeting in this church in New York City before the UN began its 63rd session.
Joan, there was another interesting event in this week in the Vatican, and that was a press conference that was held on Tuesday to draw attention to an upcoming conference that's been organised by the Pontifical Gregorian University on the origin of the species and evolution. That's a very interesting subject, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's fascinating. And when the journalists were advised of this conference, the fact that the press conference would talk about a conference that was going to take place in Rome in 2009, and normally we don't have press conferences that many months in advance, it turns out that the press conference came at the end of a three-day workshop, which was part of this overall program, part of which was going to be the big Rome conference in March of 2009. And the other sponsor, you mentioned the Gregorian University, the other sponsor of this is the Notre Dame University in Indiana in the United States. And it's kind of under the aegis, if you will, of the Pontifical Council for Culture. And there is a project called STOK, S-T-O-Q, which is Science, Theology, and the Ontological Quest. And all of this is this conference on evolution, on biological evolution, to, by the way, celebrate the 150th anniversary of the publication of Charles Darwin's The Origin of Species. And so the gentlemen present at the press conference, several priests, of course, from the Gregorian. There was a professor, Philip Sloan, from Notre Dame University. They were here to present the program and objectives of this conference in March of next year.
And our thanks there to Joan Lewis, who'll be back at this same time next week with another edition of Joan Knows. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.